Welcome to What is Going Om for New Thought from the Edge of Om. Each week on Om Time's flagship radio show, veteran broadcaster, author, and media consultant Sandy Sedgebeer conducts thought-provoking interviews with inspirational authors, artists, musicians, scientists, speakers, and filmmakers who are working at the point where spirituality and science meet consciousness at the very edge of Om. Here is your host, Sandy Sedgebeer.
Hello. In his latest book, The Religion of Tomorrow, A Vision for the Future of the Great Traditions, tonight's guest, author, leader, scholar, and founder of the Integral Institute, Ken Wilber, notes that there is a central paradox in the role of religion throughout history. On the one hand, religion has been the single greatest cause of war and suffering. On the other, it's been the single greatest source of redemption, salvation, and liberation for humanity. How can we possibly make sense of this apparently impossible contradiction, he asks. How can we reconcile the very best qualities of religion with the very worst? Ken Wilber joins me now to explain how part of the problem is that the path of waking up needs to be complemented by the path of growing up, in order to renew and replenish our understanding of enlightenment in the 21st century. Ken Wilber, welcome.
Hello, it's good to be here.
Ken, in The Religion of Tomorrow, you say that a single purpose lies at the heart of all the great religious traditions, which is awakening to the astonishing reality of the true nature of ourselves and the universe. If that is so, how is it that religion and spirituality has come to be the greatest cause of war and suffering, as well as the greatest source of redemption, salvation, and liberation? What happened to erode that focus?
Well, that's probably one of the most central questions that we can ask about religion itself. And strangely, we've only really gotten some satisfactory answers to this question in the last decade or two. And one of the ways that we can approach this is indeed by what you mentioned, which is by recognizing that there are at least two very important dimensions to religion in general. They're both equally important, but they're really quite different. And one is what we indeed call waking up, and one is what we call growing up. So waking up is, in a certain sense, it's kind of the essential core of what the world's great spiritual traditions are meant to do. So most of the great traditions maintain that the typical human being is living in a world that in some sense is less than adequate. It's referred to as a fallen world, or for Buddhists and Hindus, it's a dualistic world, a world of fragmentation and even illusion. It's a world of alienation. For certain Christians, it's a world of original sin. Any way we look at it, it's an existentially problematic, almost inferior kind of world that we typically live in. But all of the great traditions maintain that there's a certain pathway, a certain set of exercises, either some form of yoga or meditation or contemplation or centering prayer, that we can do, and it will help us discover infinitely much more wonderful world, in a sense, a world that's saved, a world that's redeemed, a world that is non-dual, a world that's awakened, enlightened. The New Testament calls it metamorphosis. It's well known in Buddhism as enlightenment, awakening. And most of the great traditions tell some version of that story. And so that whole process is what we refer to as waking up. And if you look at the world's great traditions, the great contemplative core of most of the world's great spiritual traditions, you can find certain very broad similarities in how they look at waking up, how they view enlightenment and realization. And essentially, it's moving from a fragmented, divided, isolated, suffering self, which is often not entirely correctly, but it's often just referred to as the ego or the separate self sense. And it's moving from that state to a state that's often called divine unity or oneness or wholeness. It's realized in an ultimate unity consciousness, a satori or absolute oneness with the entire ground of all being. It sounds rather grandiose because in a certain sense it is. It's literally discovering your fundamental identity with the ground of all being. And that realization is said to lead from a fallen world to a redeemed world, from a fragmented world to a whole world. And this is maintained to also bring a relief from suffering and alienation and torment that the typical ego suffers fairly constantly. And so this is the real core of most of the world's great religious and great spiritual traditions. As St. Paul put it, quote, "Let this consciousness be in you, which was in Christ Jesus, that we all may be one." And it's that unity consciousness, that oneness, that waking up to a unified reality that most of the great traditions offer as their answer to the suffering, duality, sin, and separation that most typical human beings suffer from the moment they're born. And now this kind of realization goes back at least several thousand years. And we can certainly see, if we go back to the earliest shamanic voyages, it could go back 30 or 40,000 years. It's certainly a realization that has been with humanity for most of its historical development. And so if you just look at that state, and you look at that state of awakened, unified awareness, in most traditions, it is indeed defined as also having a sort of a profound, infinite love. For the Christian tradition, of course, God is love. For the Buddhist tradition, it's compassion. And as we awaken to our ultimate unity condition, as we awaken to this unified ground of all being, we also awaken to a profound love, a profound compassion, a deep care and concern for all human beings, indeed all sentient beings, particularly because all of them, unless they've also awakened or become enlightened in their own case, all of them are suffering, all of them are hurting, all of them are in a great deal of pain. And so once we awaken and discover this genuine reality and this genuine ground of being, then we feel a natural love and care and compassion and concern for all beings. And we want to help them awaken as well. And so this is where I'm sorry?
How do we encourage that when, as you write in the book, that according to experts, 70% of the world's population is at a fundamentalist stage of development where their given religion is taken to be the literal word of God?
Well, that's where the other part of the story comes in. And so just laying out the idea that there is this waking up, and there is, but that's only half the story, because we also have the growing up component. And this is where it gets really problematic. And this is actually what explains how religion can go from offering, on the one hand, the sort of greatest source of love and compassion of anything, but it can also be the source of arguably the greatest amount of suffering, torture, murder, and warfare in humankind's history. I mean, how are both of those possible? And the answer is that it largely depends on the degree of growing up that individuals have. So even if they have a waking up experience, their growing up component will determine how they interpret it, how they actually understand it. And this is something that, strangely, this component was only discovered about 100 years ago. So there's no religion really anywhere in the world that includes this growing up component. So let me briefly explain what that component is, and I think you'll start to see why it's so important in terms of our spiritual understanding and how we actually interpret our waking up experiences. This has to do with the fact that human beings have upwards of a dozen or so what are called multiple intelligences. And so we have not only a cognitive intelligence, we have an emotional intelligence, we have an aesthetic intelligence, we have an interpersonal intelligence, we have a moral intelligence, and we also have something called a spiritual intelligence. And spiritual intelligence is different from waking up, because spiritual intelligence is part of growing up. And what growing up means is that if you look at all of these intelligences, we're not born with any of them in a fully developed or mature or in some cases even functioning way. So a six-month-old child, for example, can't, you know, perform heart surgery or be a concert pianist or understand mathematics or anything like that. All of those intelligences grow and develop. And the recent discovery that we found, again, starting about 100 years ago, is that all of these multiple intelligences grow and develop through a series of stages of development. And these stages differ really quite considerably from each other. And I'll give you just one typical example of these stages and what researchers have found about them. And the model I'm going to give right now is a very simplified form. It only has four major stages of development or stages of growing up. But most of the models in existence would agree with these stages. They're simplified, but they're accurate, and they get the point across fairly straightforwardly. And these are the stages that Carol Gilligan, a fairly well-known feminist, particularly in a book called In a Different Voice, found when she tracked the moral development of women. And she found that it goes through four basic stages. So the first stage she called selfish, because here the woman cares only for herself, basically. And we find this typically in infants that can hardly be aware of other people at all, let alone morally care for them. And so that stage is called selfish. We also call that stage egocentric, because it's focused just on oneself. And then her second stage she called care, because here the woman extends care from just herself to a group. So it can be her family, her tribe, or her nation, even fellow brothers and sisters of a particular religion. But she expands her capacity to care for other people from just herself to a group of people. But it's still just one group. She can't expand it to all groups all at once. So this stage, in addition to be called care, we also call it ethnocentric, because it's focused on your particular tribe or your particular race or your particular sex or whatever it might be. Her third stage, she called universal care. And here, the woman can extend care not just to her favorite group, but she extends care to all groups, to all human beings. And she attempts to treat all humans fairly, regardless of race, color, sex, or creed. And creed includes religious creed. And so then her fourth stage, she simply called integrated. And that's where the woman tends to integrate all of the previous stages into an overall holistic, fairly complete or comprehensive awareness or understanding. Now, it turns out that you can have a waking up experience you can have an experience of being one with the entire universe, one with spirit, one with the ground of all being, one with everything that's arising moment to moment. But you'll interpret that experience based on the stage of growing up that you're at. So if you're at an egocentric stage of development, for example, and let's say you're a Christian, and you have an experience of being one with Christ. You have an experience of your own Christ consciousness. You have an experience of being one with divine spirit. If you're truly egocentric, then you might think that experience applies only to you, that you yourself are Jesus Christ. And it's funny because Ram Dass tells a story where his brother was actually institutionalized because he was schizophrenic. He thought he himself was Jesus Christ. But Ram Dass said as soon as you met him, you could tell that he had had a really profound waking up experience. He knew that he was one with Jesus. He said you could see his authenticity. It was unmistakable. But clearly, but his brother didn't think that anybody else could have that experience, including Ram Dass. So here's somebody who has an authentic waking up experience, but he's at an egocentric stage of development. So he thinks that he and he alone can have that kind of experience. If he continued growing, and if he moved from egocentric up to ethnocentric, if he moved from selfish up to care, then he might be a fundamentalist Christian, for example. And then he has an experience of being one with Christ, realizes his own true self, his Christ consciousness. But if he's truly a fundamentalist Christian, he'll think that only those people who believe in Jesus Christ and accept him as their personal savior, only those people can have that kind of true spiritual oneness experience. Other people might think they're having a spiritual oneness, but if they don't accept Jesus, then they're not really having that kind of profound spiritual oneness. And so that person truly believes that...
Ken, I'm going to hold you right there. Hold on to those words. That person truly believes. We'll be back in a few moments. You're listening to What Is Going On. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer. My guest is author, scholar, and founder of the Integral Institute, Ken Wilber, and we're discussing his book, The Religion of Tomorrow. We'll be back with more from Ken Wilber after this break.
The future of internet radio is here. OM Times Radio. IOM FM.
Change and growth are part of natural life and also part of your spiritual life. Everyone needs support and guidance, especially during life passages. Upgrade yourself with the OM Times Experts program. With OM Times Experts, you have access to the best intuitive coaches, spiritual teachers, counselors, astrologists, and oracles. Our team was carefully selected so you can trust. Find out more at experts.omtimes.com.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
My name is Meera Batra, and this is How I Live United. Many families have come to America for a better life. I advocate for these families with United Way. United Way empowers them to see opportunities available. We help them get involved with their kids, schools, and network within the community. My name is Meera Batra. I help families see opportunity and succeed. I don't just wear the shirt. I live it.
Give, advocate, volunteer, live united. Go to liveunited.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
Welcome back, Ken Wilber. Before we pick up the thread of what you were saying, I have a question to ask you. Why do we need religion at all?
Why do we need what?
Why do we need religion?
Okay, well, in terms of what these two dimensions mean, let me just finish briefly by explaining the finishing up with the growing up side of this question, because we just talked about somebody egocentric and ethnocentric and how they can both have authentic waking up experiences, but they'll interpret it in terms of their stage of growing up. And this especially is important because if you move from ethnocentric to world-centric or to universal care, then you'll have an understanding that not only you and not only a Christian, but all human beings have access to and a capacity to experience this, have this great waking up experience, to become one with the ground of all being. And so coming from that world-centric stage of development, and that continues, by the way, at the highest stage, the integral stage, which because that combines all of them, and so it certainly includes world-centric, at those stages, you are indeed going to express a love for all human beings, regardless of race, color, sex, or creed. You could not be at a world-centric stage of growing up and engage in the Crusades. It wouldn't happen. You wouldn't have that motivation. If you're at an ethnocentric stage, however, then you'll think, as a Christian, only you have access to spirit. And the Muslim at the ethnocentric stage is going to think, well, only a Muslim has access to that spiritual reality. Everybody else is demonic, is infidels, and deserve to be killed. And over the history of humanity, the vast majority of human beings have been at the earlier stages of that growing up. So even though they've had profound waking up experiences, if they're at the lower stages of growing up, they're not going to generate impartial, universal love for all beings. They're going to have a great deal of suspicion and even hatred of those who are not part of their own group, their own tribe, so to speak. And so that's how, even though the same waking up experience can occur, it's going to just profoundly be an overall different type of situation depending on the degree of growing up that we're at. And one of the real problems, as I was saying, is that these growing up stages were only discovered about 100 years ago. And that means that there's not a single major religion anywhere on the planet that has an understanding of growing up. Most of them understand waking up. None of them understand growing up. And that's the disaster. So that's why we have religion that can both be the source of an enormous amount of love and universal compassion and care, and a source of crusades and ethnocentric jihad and holy war and overall just disastrous types of consequences. So it's really important that we understand both of these dimensions of spirituality.
So what about if we go back to, say, the Druids or certain indigenous tribes who, like the Lakota Sioux, for instance, who've never had a word for God, as far as they were concerned, nature, you know, was everything. They were at one with nature. They were at one with their surroundings. The Druids, you know, had great love for humanity, for nature, etc. Would you say that they were awake but not grown up?
Well, if they actually were awakened to the ultimate ground of being, and if they really were at a world-centric stage of development, then that would be fine. And if that was the case, then they would not engage in things like child human sacrifice. They would not engage in things like warfare or judging other tribes to be inferior. And if they did all of that, then fine. They're not a problem. If they did all of that, then they would be part of humanity that was truly exhibiting a genuine universal love. And that would be the good thing about spirituality. Very, very few earlier cultures did that, by the way. Very few.
So you're saying, I mean, you do say in the book that earlier sages were fully enlightened, but they were fully enlightened for their time, and there is a distinction there.
Well, what happens is, in the growing up dimension, human beings continue to evolve. And when it comes to the waking up dimension, human beings also, I mean, there was a time, perhaps a million years ago, when human beings did not have access to waking up. And the first human cultures that seemed to have some sort of that type of access were indeed some of the shamanic cultures, and they indeed tended to see nature as being the ultimate divine, which is fine. So they had a nature mysticism. Not too many of them were at world-centric stages of growing up, simply because for most cultures, you actually have to grow. You have to go from infancy to childhood to adolescence to adulthood. You can't go from infancy to adulthood in one step. Tends not to work. And we don't see really much evidence of that at all. And in terms of continuing to grow and develop, that's simply what happens with evolution in general. I mean, if you look at almost any discipline that we're involved in, say, physics or chemistry or science, human beings continue to learn more and more and more about those areas the longer we exist and the longer we investigate what's going on. So I think the same thing is happening. Now, even if you look at something like waking up, because on the one hand, we tend to see a lot of waking up cultures going back to things like Zen Buddhism or Vedanta Hinduism, or any of the early great spiritual traditions. But when it comes to waking up, none of them understood the brain chemistry involved or any of the brainwave patterns that were produced. Yet we're seeing research in that happening right now, and a fair amount of it, actually. So we're still continuing to learn. There's still more and more and more information that exists in the relative world. And therefore, if we're going to become, when we become one with everything, one with the ground of everything, that everything is becoming fuller and fuller and fuller as human beings continue to grow and evolve. And there's no reason that's going to stop. People 500 years from now, 1,000 years from now, will be more developed than we are, unless everything simply, you know, goes to hell or the robots take over or whatever dystopia might happen. But generally speaking, we think things are going to continue to get better.
You say much of your work over the past decade has been focused on something that you call the fourth turning of Buddhism.
Right.
Tell us about the fourth turning of Buddhism. What is it and why is it important?
Buddhism is one of the relatively few religious systems that was developed a couple thousand years ago that actually seemed to have some sort of understanding of not only evolution sort of in general, but of the fact that its own teachings were evolving. And this is a very, very profound realization. And so the Buddhists themselves, who recognized this, tended to name their own major stages of spiritual evolution. And they referred to these as the three major turnings of the wheel of Dharma. And the first turning, of course, was that was presented by Gautama Buddha. And he was the founder of the religion. And he created a form of spiritual practice that we today generally call mindfulness training. And that aimed to get a person off of the cycle of samsara, which was this dualistic, fallen, fragmented, broken world, and into a purely unmanifest, realm of nirvana. And nirvana was a complete cessation. So all manifestation stopped arising. And one got, quote, off the wheel entirely. So you weren't going to be reborn. You weren't going to suffer anymore. You weren't going to feel any pain anymore. And this is a very real state of consciousness that you can get in. It's actually, you can sort of think of it as one of the early stages of waking up. But it's very real, and we saw examples of being in this state of pure nirvana, which Buddha said is a state without pain, without suffering, without ego, without desire. And we saw examples of this during the Vietnam War, when monks who were protesting the war got into the meditation posture and then got into this state of nirvana or pure cessation and had their bodies doused in gasoline and set on fire. And right on live TV, they literally burned to the ground in ashes and didn't flinch once. I mean, this is a very real state. They really were in a state of no pain, no suffering, no desire, no ego. And that was the first turning. And this is what Buddhism offered, a discovery of a ground of all being, which also got them off of the whole manifest world of finite things and events, which the Buddha said was just a world of suffering. But then the second turning, which was initiated by the Buddhist genius called Nagarjuna. Nagarjuna actually criticized Gotama and said, nirvana is real, but it's actually a partial state itself. It's not truly whole or holistic because nirvana is separated from samsara. So it's actually dividing reality into two parts. And it's only identifying with half of it. It's only identifying with nirvana. It simply pushes samsara away. And Nagarjuna says that's just not right. There's a deeper reality that includes both nirvana and samsara. It includes both emptiness and the world of form. And these are actually not two. And so this whole revolution was referred to as non-duality. And Buddhism at that point, in its second turning, became its belief and its actual waking up capacity switched from a state that's called turiya, which means pure, vast emptiness, to turiya tita, which means non-dual. And so in that state, you're fully in touch with nirvana, but you're also fully in touch with everything that's arising moment to moment. So you're resting in emptiness, but you're fully embracing all form. You're not pushing form away. You're not denying it. You're not getting off that wheel. You're actually embracing it. You're encompassing it. And so that became a much bigger reality in that sense. And all the schools of Buddhism that developed beyond that point referred to themselves as Mahayana Buddhism, which meant big vehicle. And within that bigger vehicle, the third turning occurred. And that was generally what's known as Vajrayana, which became especially associated with Tibetan Buddhism. And what that school did was introduce a whole lot of intermediate realms, subtle realms, that were not pure nirvana, but they were much subtler than typical gross samsara. And so this included ways that sexual energies, for example, could be used on the spiritual path, and virtually any form of emotions that were arising, instead of being repressed or attempted to push out of awareness, you'd actually embrace them. And so Vajrayana was a sort of an even greater expansion, because it was finding new elements of the finite manifest world that were real and that could be included in a true waking up. And so out of Vajrayana, for example, came the whole tantric movement, which was actually using sexuality as a means to realize a spiritual enlightenment. And sexuality and spirituality were not two. And so the people that proposed that there was a third turning also understood that at some point there would be a fourth turning. And a fair number of the Buddhist teachers that I've worked with, they feel that introducing these other dimensions to spirituality, since no spiritual system anywhere does this, but since it's clearly important, I mean, you want to develop not only from an unenlightened state, but to a state of waking up. You also want to develop from an immature state to a state of growing up. Both of those are important, and yet not a single religion anywhere in the world does that. And so these folks have suggested, and I agree, it's at least possible, that understanding would be eligible to constitute a fourth turning in Buddhism. But those of us who believe this, those of us who are sort of working with all of these dimensions, feel that almost any spiritual system anywhere is open to this and should actually seriously consider it. This is information we have. There's an overwhelming amount of evidence that it's real, and it certainly seems to explain an enormous bit about human history and how we've approached our spirituality during the ages.
I'm finding this not particularly easy to understand. I think I'm grasping it. You have talked about spiritual intelligence and waking up and growing up, two stages of development. There are two more, cleaning up and showing up. And you also talk about the dysfunctions in the different states and structures of consciousness, which I would like to look at when we come back from the break.
Okay.
For a few moments, Ken. You're listening to What Is Going On. I'm Sandy Sedgbear, and my guest is Ken Wilber, and we're discussing his book, The Religion of Tomorrow, A Vision for the Future of the Great Traditions. We'll be back in a few moments.
The cutting edge of conscious radio, Om Times Radio, IOM FM. Being a radio host on IOM FM allows you to build your show on a rich platform with the power of the internet to fulfill your outreach goals and connect with a very specialized and global online audience, unlimited by time and distance. Om Times Radio will provide you with web relevance, a recognizable conscious brand, and with the standard of excellence that has accompanied every single Om Times endeavor. Host your show with Om Times Radio Network.
My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern on Om Times Radio, and we'll explore these topics and so much more on Destination Unlimited.
I'm Fidel Nshombo. I was born in a city called Bukavu in the Congo.
We were a loving family. And then, boom, everything that I had disappeared in a single day.
People think that when you are a refugee and they resettle you to America, you know, your problems are done. They don't understand that that's the beginning of everything.
I was not born a refugee. I was made one.
It's time we welcome refugee families with open arms. Learn more at EmbraceRefugees.org, brought to you by the Ad Council.
Welcome back. Ken Wilber, we were talking about spiritual intelligence and waking up and growing up as two of the stages of development. Tell us about the other two, cleaning up, which is shadow work, and showing up.
What we have been doing here as we look at waking up and growing up is actually looking at the various areas that spirituality itself applies to when it comes to human beings. Because what we're finding is that most people just don't know the full riches of what a genuine spirituality can encompass. and the many extraordinarily positive potentials and capacities that a full-bodied spirituality can bring. And one of them is that, as we're saying, a genuinely full spirituality would help you not only wake up, it would help you grow up. But then we also find that there are a couple other areas that it can help with as well. And it's also important that these areas be taken into account because they're going to show up anyway. And if we're not consciously dealing with them, then they'll simply sort of unconsciously hit us over the head. And one of them we call cleaning up. And most people know what cleaning up is. And it has to do with the human capacity to have unconscious impulses and values and complexes, commonly associated with the name of Freud. But there are many different approaches to it, and it's sort of generally referred to as doing shadow work. Shadow being our unconscious material, stuff that we have that belongs to us, but that we're unaware of, or that we repress or push out of awareness, or we don't want to deal with, or we're afraid to deal with. And so whenever we have some impulse like that, or some idea, or some quality, or some value, and for whatever reason we dislike it, we think it's bad, we don't like experiencing it, we tend to push it out of awareness. We repress it, we hide it. Often we'll project that hidden or dislike quality onto other people, and then we think they possess a lot of that nasty quality, whether it's anger or sexual impulses or a power drive or a self-controlling tendency. And so we don't like that in ourselves. We push it out of our own mind and tend to see it in other people. So cleaning up simply means working with your own shadow material. Simply including some amount of shadow work in your own spiritual development. Because one of the things that spiritual development does, particularly if you're doing meditative practices or contemplative practices, you're working on waking up types of awareness, is that a lot of shadow material can be generated in some of these situations. And it simply takes being aware of that, looking for that, and knowing some techniques that can help you deal with your own shadow material. And so that's what we call cleaning up. And then the other one, showing up, is a little bit more technical. It simply has to do with the fact that human beings have several different major dimensions that they have access to. And all of these dimensions are important, but for some reason, they're not always included. And there are several different ways to talk about these dimensions. We can say that they refer to the good, the true, and the beautiful. That also refers to morals, science, and art. And in Buddhism, we find Buddha, Sangha, and Dharma. The pronouns are I, we, and it. And these are different dimensions. But they're all important. Usually they have completely, entirely different types of human investigative techniques that deal with these different dimensions. So the techniques you use to determine what's morally correct is different from trying to determine what's scientifically true. And that's different from determining what has artistic merit. But the point is that all three of those are important. And there's then a whole bunch of sort of academic stuff that goes with that. But the whole sum total is that we want to show up for all of these dimensions. We want to be able to include the good and the true and the beautiful. We want to include art and morals and science, and not simply claim that only one of them, like science, is true and morals and art aren't true or aren't important. And that also has to do with how we approach spirituality. So if you just believe in objective science and you study meditation, then you'll study changes in brainwaves. You'll study changes in neurotransmitters. You'll study some sort of objective scientific approach to the brain. And if you believe in first person or subjective reality, then you'll approach meditation as the changes that occur in your awareness, in your own first person feelings, and how that changes and evolves as you continue to practice. And the only point is that, again, we want to include both of those. Both of them are very important. And very few people actually go to the trouble of including both of those on this program, as you discuss the relation of science and spirituality, for example. That just means that those are two very important dimensions, and we want to show up for both of them. We want to include both of them. So that's what showing up is. So the overall sort of sum total of this is that the way we look at spirituality today is very, very limited and very narrow in comparison to what it could be. And the stuff that it could be is not just a waking up, but also a growing up and a cleaning up and a showing up. And these are things that an individual essentially would want to do in their life anyway, because each one of those areas deals with something extremely important. And we're running into all of those realities all the time anyway. And so we can either acknowledge them and then look at all of the evidence that we have for all of these areas. I mean, there's a striking amount of evidence for waking up. There's a striking amount of evidence for growing up, also for cleaning up and showing up. And if we're not including those, then we're simply leaving something really important out of our lives. And spirituality can itself expand to embrace these other areas. And if we do that, we just get a much more complete, a much more full, more comprehensive approach to spirituality. And it also works better. It's more effective. It's more efficient. And you can accomplish these goals at a quicker and fuller and more effective rate. So
is it not possible that this is happening naturally? Earlier last year, I interviewed a lady called Diana Butler Bass, who's a leading commentator on religion, politics, and culture. And she wrote a book, one of nine books that she's written, called Grounded, Finding God in the World, A Spiritual Revolution, in which she was explaining how there's been a shift from a vertical understanding of God to a God found on the horizons of nature and in human community, and that this is at the heart of a spiritual revolution that's surrounding us, that's challenging not only religious institutions, but political and social ones as well. So is this not evidence of the fact that, you know, it sounds like there's an awful lot of work to be done, but is it also not organic and it is happening regardless?
Well, yes, all of these different areas are happening in any event. As I say, we have simply a stunning amount of evidence that all human beings have access to all of these areas. Again, the evidence for it is simply overwhelming. And if you're not including some of those, I mean, if, for example, you're not aware of the stages of growing up, you're still going to go through them. And again, we have evidence for this is simply overwhelming. It's been done in hundreds of thousands of people have been tested for these things. And some of them have been tested in over 40 different cultures, and we find no major exceptions to them. And then you can always find, you know, various disciplines in cultures around the world that acknowledge these and that take them into account. So they're all organically arising and occurring, and they're all occurring together. They're happening in any event. People are always at some stage of growing up. They're always at some point of waking up. They always have some amount of shadow material or not. And so that's happening in any event. And all we want to do here is identify and consciously recognize as many of those organic components as we can. Simply the fact that we learn about them doesn't mean that they're not organic, and it doesn't mean that we're not being organic. As a matter of fact, we're being much more holistic than the people that leave them out.
Your comprehensive integral approach is already being applied to several world religions by some of their adherents in the belief that it can avert a cultural disaster of unparalleled proportions. What evidence of transformation are you seeing among those that are applying it?
Well, one of the immediate changes is that the addition of the growing up component, because people sort of left to their own devices, don't tend to notice these interior stages of growing up. These stages are very much like the rules of grammar. You and I are now both following the rules of grammar of the English language, a quite complex set of rules. But if anybody asks us to write down what those rules are, you and I, neither one of us can do that. So the stages of growing up that a person's at are just like the rules of grammar. When a person's at that stage, they're using that stage, they're interpreting the world according to that stage, they have no idea they're doing it, and they certainly can't write down what the patterns or characteristics of that stage are. And so as people become aware of that, it changes their worldviews considerably, because they realize that people that they're disagreeing with, or they realize that there is conflict areas in the world, not only have, you know, a technological dimension and an economic dimension and a political dimension, they also have an interior dimension where people's awareness is the stage of growing up that it's at changes profoundly how they interact with the world. And as people start to just understand that, let alone start to sort of look at some of these stages and see exactly how they are impacting not only their own lives, but the whole realm of politics and international politics and global issues. These are all impacted profoundly by the stages of growing up of the individuals that are involved. And as that just becomes an understanding, and if you even, you know, spend a little bit of time and just look at, you know, one model of growing up, just even the Carol Gilligan simple model that we talked about, and you start checking and seeing, okay, here's a conflict area I'm looking at. What stages are involved here? And you can almost always see that there are several stages involved, and that's a large part of the problem, is that these stages aren't matching up very well. It changes your life considerably. It gives an enormous amount of understanding about why certain things are happening. And that's certainly something that's important when it comes to the religious dimension of our lives. Because unfortunately for most people, religion means just learning a single dogmatic viewpoint, and then you're supposed to look at everything through that single viewpoint. And as it turns out, every major religion is coming from one of these major stages of growing up. And so if you're just plugged into the dogma of your religion, then you're only looking at the world through one narrow perspective. And that's not going to help. It's certainly not going to help with world peace or world poverty or ecological global warming. It's not going to help at all. As a matter of fact, it's going to hurt. So these really tend to have a really big impact on people that take a little bit of time to learn it. And it is new for most people, so they do have to, you know, read a book or two about it or watch a YouTube video or whatnot. It's not something that they're generally aware of already. Most people, as a matter of fact, aren't even aware that there's a waking up component to spirituality, that there actually is something called enlightenment or metamorphosis or satori. So this is a little bit new for a lot of people, and we acknowledge that. But that doesn't mean that, you know, it's not worth having a look at.
Now, you say that the religion of tomorrow will not be one religion, but all religions guide in their respective constituents toward oneness with ultimate reality. I don't go to many different churches, but when I was in England at Christmas, I did happen to go to, you know, one of the average churches. Certainly, religion, Orthodox religion there seems to be dying. Churches no longer have the congregations that they used to have. Are you proposing that, you know, the local vicar becomes trained in integral theory and begins to teach all of these stages so that their congregation actually gets it from the vicar or from, you know, their church leader, or that people, you know, discover this for themselves and take themselves through the processes? Darn it, we're out of time. Just give me a one-word
answer. Thank you.
I'm sorry, we're going to have to leave it there. Kim Wilber, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Sandy. Bye now.
Ken Wilber is the founder of Integral Institute and the co-founder of Integral Life. If you would like more information about his work, his books, Integral Theory, visit kenwilber.com and integrallife.com. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer. Thanks for joining me today, and I look forward to being with you again at the same time next week. Till then, it's goodbye from me.